You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 22nd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor at Claremont McKenna College, Lily Geismer. On her book, Don't Blame Us, Suburban Liberals and the Transformation of the Democratic Party. Speaking of which, President Obama taking it to the streets for the TPP, or I should say taking it to a friendly conference with some tech investors and Chris Matthews to make his case for the TPP. It's like sort of like the street, sort of like the Wall Street. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren starting to start the battle. Harry Reid weighs in. No way is he supporting the TPA. The question is, will the president get the votes he needs from Democrats in the House to go along with the votes he already has of the Republicans? Also on the program today, the head of the DEA steps down. Could this be the beginning of the end of the federal marijuana prohibition in this country? Looks like the Loretta Lynch nomination is going forward. And new surveys show that the most strident opposition to the Affordable Care Act comes from people who most clearly don't have to deal with the Affordable Care Act at all. All that and more. In Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania government has taken the horrible, horrible step of allowing people to have the most meager of assets and still get food assistance. Why do we keep feeding people who can't afford to feed themselves? How many lottery winners are we going to have to let be on food stamps in this country? I'm being somewhat facetious. I hope people pick up on that. In Pennsylvania, one of the upshots of voting out real a-holes, Governor Tom Corbett was voted out just 6 months ago, I guess, from the governorship in Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania will now eliminate the acid test for food stamps as of Monday, I guess in a week from more or less from today. There are only 12 states, now they will go down to 11, that institute these asset tests. In other words, people are eligible to get food stamps based on their income. If you lose your job, and you have a home and you have a car and you have an IRA, you may look like you're very wealthy. And you may indeed have a decent amount of wealth. But if you have no income coming in, you're going to have to eat away at that wealth. Now, this asset test did not include one car, did not include a house, and did not include a pension. But let's say you've put away $7,500 in savings, which maybe you're going to use to, I don't know, go to night school. You've lost your job and you want to pick up a different trade. Or maybe you've saved that money to help your kids do something. Or to pay for, I don't know, childcare. If you have over $5,500 in Pennsylvania today, and you have no income whatsoever, you have to spend that money down to get the whatever it is, $200 a month, to get you with some help with food stamps. In other words, you have to remain poor and not build any assets whatsoever or maintain any assets if you want to eat. And fortunately, Tom Corbett was voted out, and that's going to end in Pennsylvania. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Lily Geismer about what happened to the Democratic Party. Also, want to remind you, you can be listening to this show via our app. You can pick it up for free at majorityapp.com. All right, we'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Professor at Claremont McKenna College. Lily Geismer, author of Don't Blame Us, Suburban Liberals and the Transformation of the Democratic Party. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I'm going to do my best. This is a you're tracking the rightward tack by the Democratic Party over the past 30, 40 years, I guess. And you look at five suburban communities in Massachusetts as a way of illustrating where the Democratic Party has gone. So let me first just say that I'm going to do my best as a Worcester native to try and keep my accent in check as we talk about these communities, because I don't want to slip into my parody of my Massachusetts accent at any time. So with that up front, let's start with Don't Blame Us, because I remember this as a kid, frankly. Where did the title Don't Blame Us come from?
So the title comes from a bumper sticker that appeared in Massachusetts after the election of George McGovern, after the election of Richard Nixon in 1972, where Nixon won every state but Massachusetts. And so George McGovern won the state of Massachusetts, and the bumper sticker is a reference to that. So don't blame me. I'm from Massachusetts, and then also it appeared after Watergate. And so it became a symbol of how the state of Massachusetts sort of stands against the national tide as this sort of this bastion of liberalism in the increase the sort of increased conservatism of the rest of the country, and kind of as a sort of sense of self-righteousness against the rest of everyone else who voted for Nixon.
And I mean, I think it's fair to say that your book argues that both McGovern actually, in many respects, shifted where the Democratic Party was heading in many ways, and that, in fact, that moment signaled where, I guess, the idea of Massachusetts liberals not necessarily so liberal or as liberal as I think we sort of imagine them to be.
Yeah, so the idea of the title was to sort of, challenge that assumption of the state standing in for this kind of bastion of American liberalism, and to think about how it's not actually exceptional, but a model for larger transformations that have happened within within the Democratic Party and then national politics as a whole. And so some of it is it's not necessarily a rightward shift as much as a kind of the argument that I make is that it's a more of a shift in it's the sort of class allegiances and location, sort of away from the more labor-oriented working class who are the base of the Democratic Party for much of the 20th century, towards a more sort of suburban-oriented base of kind of engineers and knowledge workers and people like that who are more in the suburban periphery. And that's something that happened in Massachusetts. So I trace that trend, but the other question is thinking about McGovern, who often sort of is famous for the idea that he sort of stood for the three A's of amnesty, abortion, and acid, and that he actually was at the forefront of a type of Democratic Party politics that was appealing to these kinds of voters on issues of high tech, the environment, those and sort of quality of life issues. And I also look at the same thing with Michael Dukakis, who has also been sort of lambasted as a kind of Massachusetts liberal. And these politicians set a set of agenda and sort of and strategies actually anticipate what the where the party is going. And so Obama uses a very similar, and Clinton in the 90s is a very similar strategy. So you can see, you can track these this trend happening over a longer period.
I mean, let's clarify too this idea of, because I think I say right word, and I'm saying right word, I guess, in terms of the Democratic Party, in terms of, I guess, an economic perspective, right? I mean, specifically in the question of race, because I mean, excuse me, race, in terms of the question of money, as opposed to more, I guess, socially liberal things. And I mean, is that a fairly accurate assessment?
Yeah, and I think this is where it's so hard to sort of identify labels of right and left, and where this particular constituency is a great way to think about that, because on many of the sort of traditional social issues that they would be considered left. I mean, sort of environment, affirmative action to some degree. They're very opposed to the Vietnam War, but are very fiscally moderate, and particularly, I mean, I think this is where you see my argument is about sort of the larger Democratic Party with this group of people as their major constituency. It helps explain some of the party's lack of sort of particularly addressing more structurally based solutions to economic problems and to racial problems. And so that's some of the how and why those issues have not fully been addressed by the party. There are other factors too, but this is a sort of key piece in it. So they tend to be particularly the set of this constituency very individually focused. And so the key part of my argument is to sort of suggest that they tend to be the most liberal on issues that are the furthest away from their property values, tax rates, and kids' education.
Yeah, at one point you write. I guess this is in the in your introduction. You write, suburban liberals achieved the greatest victories in campaigns that proposed individualist solutions to rights-related issues, required limited financial sacrifice, and offered tangible quality of life benefits. I mean, this has been a critique of liberals that I've heard for at least 20 or 30 years. I think, you know, Mort Saul was talking about everybody's a liberal till it costs them a dime. And on this program, we've had Fran Lebowitz talk about the problem with liberalism is a moneyed one. And and on some level, I think you're suggesting, well, your research shows that part of this is a function of this migration to suburbia. I mean, is that it? Because you adopt different set of values there?
Yeah, I mean, I think particularly in the suburbs that there's puts up and sort of this has been the history of mass suburbanization in the United States, but it's put a strong emphasis on especially property values and the sort of importance of home ownership. And that those kinds of that set of sort of individual values that come with the politics of home ownership breeds this kind of liberalism. And so I think that that's some of the what I wanted to look at is the ways in which that emphasis on suburban the experience of living in the suburbs can reshape these larger sort of political questions. And it's sort of and really it's about the sort of suburbanization of liberalism that as more and more liberals are living in the suburbs, how is that shaping their values?
And I mean, is it, I mean, I guess, you know, it's, I don't know how relevant it is to question whether or not it is, they're still maintaining their perspective as liberals on some level. I don't know. I mean, they're certainly not leftists. I mean, just what's your sense of that? I mean, just in terms of the nomenclature.
Yeah, well, I think, and that was one thing I really struggled with, was what term to call, that there are a lot of other terms that get identified to this particular group of people. And I picked up the word suburban liberal, which is actually what they call themselves, and they sort of see themselves very much in line with as liberal. So it's not left, and it's not they wouldn't call themselves conservative either. And I think this is that hard question of how to define. I mean, I think that this is a struggle of how to define liberalism. But they're not, and there is a really my research looks at a lot of political activism that was going on within these suburban communities. I mean, a lot of the people who live there got really involved in civil rights groups.
Yeah, I want to get to those actions in a bit. I mean, and they certainly when you hear the activism, it is again sort of primarily focused on what we perceive as socially liberal, goals.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to
well, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, I grew up in Massachusetts, and one of the things that struck me about your book was just sort of remembering Proposition 2.5, which came in the early 80s, which was sort of, I guess, adopted from a similar law in California, which basically capped, if I remember correctly, the property taxes capped the amount of property taxes that would be spent on public school. And I remember, like, I think it was, you know, in when I entered in high school, all of a sudden, like, everything was cut. Like everything was cut, like literally 1/4 to 1/3 of what was in that school the year before was just gone. And that to me does not, you know, you hear this notion of you come from liberal Massachusetts and meanwhile they're destroying public education because they don't want to pay property taxes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should say my Massachusetts roots come out that I interrupt people. It always comes up in California, so I apologize for that. But I think when I describe this to my students in California, where the Proposition 13 and the tax revolt get so much attention, there's an idea that Proposition 2.5 sounds like it was the lesser tax revolt, but it actually was having a 2.5% cap on property taxes, which passed in 1980, was an incredibly stringent law, and I think has fundamentally defined a lot of the sort of these fiscally oriented politics. And I think that's one of those places of thinking about how exactly what you said, how the state. This doesn't necessarily gel with the state's image, but where it really is on the forefront of American politics, and it helps in Michael Dukakis's effective sort of economic turnaround of the state, which then leads to his nomination for the Democratic presidency in 1988. So it has these larger effects, but I think that nationally, and then it affected people at their day-to-day life. That you had a lot of the programs cut from your schools, and highlight some of these kinds of fiscal politics.
And let me ask you,
identify the state.
Before we actually dig into these five communities and talk about the sort of the history of these of the political activism there, again, let me ask you just again sort of more broadly as to like why, how can you be so sure when you do this research that that these communities are representative? I mean, one thing that I've always found stuff about Massachusetts politics to be strange insofar as like, you know, if I remember correctly, it took a long time to get the seatbelt law passed in Massachusetts. Just people really had a problem with that. And there's just a very strange mix of parochialism in Massachusetts, to my experience. And, you know, granted, I'm coming from Worcester, and which is, you know, incredibly parochial, I think, for the size of city. And there's weird sort of race issues in Massachusetts that I guess seem stranger just because it has a different reputation.
Well, I think that's where a lot of the ways that the state's reputation obscures these larger realities, and so why it's such a sort of rich site for thinking about larger political change. And so some of the things about particularly on the issues of, so I think some of the parochialism comes from both the Puritan roots, but then also the large amount of Catholics who are in the state. And I will say, I was surprised to learn, having grown up there, the large roots of very liberal Catholics in Massachusetts who actually shape liberal politics. But there's a whole other tradition that I think does shape a certain amount of parochialism. And then the other big question is the issue of race, which was one that really inspired me to be interested in the topic in the first place, which is how do you have the same, so you have George McGovern winning only the state of Massachusetts and this bastion of liberalism, and then 2 years later as the Boston busing crisis erupts, which is considered the kind of the most violent act, sort of racial confrontation of the 1970s, and sort of earned the Boston reputation of the Little Rock of the North. And so aren't necessarily, there's a way of explaining how those two things are linked. And so that was some of what I wanted to understand.
Well, let's look at, I mean, tell us the five communities that you look at, and then and I want to get to that sort of the way that McGovern, the juxtaposition of the McGovern victory versus the busing. But you cover five communities that are on 128, and I spent a lot of time riding on 128 many times. I had friends in Gloucester and friends down in the Cape, and so there was a lot of time spent on 128. But that is it's the big tech corridor in Massachusetts. Why those five communities, and how does those communities sort of manifest this new? And we should say also, I guess before we even got into this, that the reason why these it's not just that these are indicative of a change in the demographics of the Democratic Party, but they're also an incredibly powerful. They have more power than they may have numbers, right, in terms of the demographics within the Democratic Party. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes. And so one of the pieces of my argument is to say that this is a group of people, and so suburban liberals and the kind of people that I study, are demographically quite small, but they hold a tremendous amount of power. Just because of their, for a number of different reasons, of their sort of, their both sort of intellectual capital and then political capital and economic capital give them a particular amount of power. And so the reason I picked the towns I did, so Route 128 is the kind of Silicon Valley of Massachusetts. And actually in the 50s and 60s, it surpassed Silicon Valley as the kind of tech corridor in the United States. And the communities I look at are, it's the towns of Concord, Lexington, Newton, Lincoln, and Brookline. And so those towns will hopefully have some residence to people, even if they haven't spent a lot of time in Massachusetts, as sort of these historic communities. But in the 1950s and 60s, there's a huge migration of new residents who move there largely who have ties to, who either went to Harvard or MIT and have ties to this kind of tech or academic world that's emerging. And so the question that I have, that I look at sort of how this migration of kind of these new sort of knowledge workers to these communities, which have a reputation of being sort of old historic communities, becomes a sort of, becomes a real sort of, cauldron of a new kind of liberalism that emerges. And this is a similar kind of trend emerges across the country, but it's particularly pronounced in Massachusetts, because of the kind of, for historical factors, and then also because of this, the rise of this sort of post-industrial economy. And the reason I picked the towns there was a particular set of political issues that I was interested in pursuing, and they were the towns that most clearly identified them. And I in some ways, I stacked the deck a little bit because having grown up in Massachusetts, I knew that these were communities that had strong reputations as being very liberal and extraordinarily, and the other thing is extraordinarily affluent too. So that's another sort of feature of them that they, one of the things I sort of talk about in the book, building on this idea of kind of exceptionalism, is that they're all communities that don't look like traditional suburbs. So there's a lot of the idea that we're not like the sort of mass-produced suburbs, but that also means that that makes them even more affluent. And so most of the towns have a one-acre minimum lot zoning policy, and have very stringent building codes. You can't have anything other than a single family home on a large plot of land.
And which does both those things, right? Like, we're not going to allow for, suburban sprawl on one hand. And on the other hand, we're also not going to allow for people who aren't that wealthy to live here.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the question that I have in looking at the sort of confrontation of these issues is that a lot of these communities are very active. A lot of people move there who have liberal values and get really involved in the issue of fair housing and voluntary integration for schools. But there's big conflicts that emerge when the towns try to go beyond that and bring in affordable housing in the 1970s. And so there's incredibly fierce battles in these communities over the construction of affordable housing.
Yeah.
And I use that as a kind of way to think about those tensions.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's sort of fascinating about this. I mean, I feel like I grew up with that. My step-grandfather was very based in sort of like these arm's length notion of in terms of race of what was right and that people deserved equal rights, et cetera. He was very, very explicit about that, and then would also say, I don't like these people. and so there was a sort of always that sort of like weird. I mean, I remember when he, I guess at one point, felt I was old enough to understand that, and I was really taken aback. But to some level, that really sort of explains a lot of what we see with these communities, which is an intense sense of like there must be justice, just not in this specific environment around where I'm living.
Yeah, and so my argument is absolutely what you described, is that the part that there has to be justice and equal rights is liberal. I mean, those are fall in line with traditional liberal values. But the other part of it is this idea of, as long as it doesn't affect my property values or tax rates, or particularly my kids. And I think that it's a lot of it has to do with my kids' education. So anything that's going to sort of affect the quality of those things, that's where you see the line's drawn. And my argument is that that's not a contradiction. That's actually where that's what liberalism has become.
And you also, I mean, the other issues you talk about are, I guess to a certain extent, they all sort of, they meld together, at least like civil rights and environmentalism sort of, intersect at that notion of like, well, we want to protect the environment. We don't want this urban sprawl. It also has the benefit of sort of maintaining a homogeneous quality to our community. And talk about, you also mentioned, have a chapter on feminism and on peace in regards particularly to the Vietnam War. Talk about those issues and how, again, they manifest this sort of, I guess you could call it, dichotomy.
Yeah, well, so one of the things that's amazing is that this, the other component of suburban liberals is that they're, or the people I say, is that they're incredibly effective politically. And so I think one thing, both are demographically small, but one thing I've learned is that from studying suburban politics is that a small group of people can actually have a tremendous amount of power if they're mobilized. And so they work really well to get a lot of legislation passed on these particular issues. And so in environmentalism, they help sort of Massachusetts get some of the more wide-reaching environmental laws in the country. But it's especially around the issues of open space, and that's about kind of in a town like Concord. Today, a fourth of the town is under some sort of conservation from either the state, local, or private land, or private foundations, which makes it really hard to build anything new. So in some ways, that is, it's about protecting sprawl, but that also makes it extraordinarily exclusive. So that's a way of thinking about the sort of individualist and material components of environmental politics. And so some of it is to sort of think about how all of these things become linked and to sort of think about the individualist dimensions of a lot of these kinds of political issues. And so feminism is another one where in the 70s, many of the communities become really at the forefront of pushing for feminism, but it's a lot about the sort of ideas of rights-based feminism and ideas of choice and not a more collective vision of feminist politics. So that would address a larger range of women's experiences, especially around race and class. And so think about all of these things together and sort of think about that dichotomy of the driving force of sort of thinking about equality, but then as a couple with sort of a profound amount of individualism.
So when we're talking about in terms of feminism, to reiterate and see if I understand, we're talking, you see a big push in terms of choice, like you said, but what accounts for the fact that is it simply because, you know, questions of where feminism intersects with race and intersects with class, you don't hear much coming from these people because they're white and rich, essentially?
No, I think some of it is not, that is the thing of not, like, the question of the blaming works in a couple of different ways. And one of my arguments is that, like, how much these people, many of the people, there's a certain level of sort of well-meaningness to a lot of the kinds of politics, and I mean, a genuine commitment, but they largely live in all white exclusive communities. And so I think that it shapes the frame of reference in a lot of different ways, that they're not always accustomed to thinking about the variety of different experiences of people. And so there's often this very sort of middle-class suburban-based vision shaped by their own experiences.
Are these the soccer moms? I mean, are these just soccer moms? Like, we don't hear so much about them. I don't know why we haven't heard so much about them in this way. But is this? I mean, when we used to hear about soccer moms, I think it was maybe in 2008. Is this who we're talking about?
I think it's less. I think it's a more sort of politicized version of a soccer mom. And I'm trying to think of a kind of if there's a corollary. I mean, I think that and one of the things I talked about at the end is I think this is a lot of the same people who actually now live in more urban-based communities.
Right.
There's been a huge shift, and so it's more like the kind of that's more where the activism has merged. So I think that because I think the idea of soccer moms were swing voters, and these aren't swing; these are sort of more committed to especially the Democratic Party nationally. And more issue-based activists.
Is this, I mean, on some level, does this sort of, I guess, the suburban liberals who are sort of knowledge-based, is the creative class their, I guess, their kids who are just not making quite as much money, living in, in Brooklyn or in, I guess now in JP in Boston?
Yeah, no, exactly. And so, Silver Lake, where I live in LA, that's very much, I think, where this has sort of shifted. And I think a lot of the question in a lot of those communities is a similar thing of we don't live in the sort of typical suburbs. You see that same kind of sort of sense of we want certain high quality of life, but it's a similar set of kind of individualist values. So I think it's very much the kind of the anticipation of the creative class.
And so,
which is deeply individualistic and sort of meritocratic in a lot of ways.
But is it more, is the creative class slightly more, I guess, and I'll use the word progressive because I'm talking about economic issues, because A, they're not doing as well as their parents. B, they're living in an urban environment, and so the sort of the calculations are different. They're not as necessarily focused on, you know, that 1 acre. Because I'm trying to get a sense of, like, Obama, and I think you made this argument, reflects this, the sort of the culmination on some level of those suburban liberals, which is why sometimes what he does is mystifying to liberals more broadly speaking. I mean, is that also fair, or?
Yeah, well, I think the Obama component, I mean, Obama won overwhelming number of people in the tech industry, and so a lot of the people in the creative class have some sort of loose connection to sort of tech-oriented jobs, and even though they're not living on an acre plot of land, buying an apartment buying a condo in Silver Lake is almost comparable in price. So I think that there's a similar kind of class-based identity emerging, and it's actually had similar effects. I mean, that it's driven out a lot of low-income residents from various different communities. I mean, there's the same thing that there's this solution of sort of living in urban areas that hasn't necessarily been a solution. And the other thing is that this has been a driving force in shaping larger kind of redevelopment patterns, in that there's a huge amount of emphasis on kind of bringing the same kind of tech-oriented jobs that first brought people out to the suburbs, and companies on Route 28 are now moving into Boston. There's the huge redevelopment of the Seaport area. I know this has happened in cities across the country, and so it's this and all the sort of politics and questions around in San Francisco. So I think it's actually largely in line with that pattern, even if it's not necessarily in the suburbs.
This may be outside of your portfolio, but is there anything that is predictive that you see? I mean, based upon your, I guess, retrospectively looking at this sort of move to the suburbs and the sort of change in values from a group of people within the Democratic Party and identify themselves as liberals, which sort of, because they had outsized influence on the Democratic Party, which I imagine is a function of both, like, the amount of money that they have and perhaps something to do with their lifestyle. They had access to not as sort of crowded, and so the amount of influence, right? I mean, you get a representative from your state, and you may have more access to them just because there's not as many people around, it seems to me. Go ahead.
I think that's absolutely, and that's one of the things that makes Massachusetts slightly sort of distinctive, in that it's so small. And so you see this amount. I mean, I found this a lot when I was looking at the archives and papers of organizations, but a lot of them had personal connections to many of the kind of representatives and things like that. And so that does give you a particular amount of power. You can see those relationships become concentrated. But I didn't mean to cut you off.
No. So is there anything that's predictive? I mean, in other words, can you get a sense of where any trends are happening? I mean, now that, you know, those folks are now theoretically, I guess, in their 60s and 70s, right? What is happening? I mean, where do you get the sense that the Democratic Party is moving? Is it still following that same trajectory, or has it changed?
I think it's very much still following this. Trend. I mean, I think that's one thing you've seen over the emphasis that Obama, the key words in many of Obama's, particularly campaign speeches, that have put a strong emphasis on sort of high-tech growth and ideas of kind of opportunity but not necessarily these kinds of meaningful sort of structural, these questions of kind of structurally changing the economy. and which is, has made him very popular in both the kind of suburban communities that I look at, but also in sort of these rising sort of urban-based areas. And I think that's something that'll probably continue to increase. And I think that this is both it's a source of the sort of creative class tech community, the source of both influence and then also financial influence on the party. So we'll see more of that happening.
Lily Geismer, the book is Don't Blame Us, Suburban Liberals and the Transformation of the Democratic Party. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. And it was great to talk to another Massachusetts native.
Indeed. All right. So long. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That, I did it, and I fell into it at the end. So she said another Massachusetts native. I was like, so long. That was great.
Oh, that was good.
That was very good. So you're in California now. I hope you're not supporting the Lakers.
Hope you're not smiling
too much. Go Celtics. It's interesting because that, you know, the Silver Lake is where my sister lives. So that's what happens, right?
You
go to the suburbs.
You
know, it's funny because when I was in college, this is mid-1980s, my high school had been devastated by Proposition 2.5. I was a big fan of Paul Tsongas and Michael Dukakis, and I don't think my politics were – I think I was as influenced by the perception that Massachusetts were liberal on across the board as anything else. And I, you know, it's only until later, and some of, I think this book instructed me, at least in terms of Dukakis, I was more recently aware earlier aware of this about Tsongas, is that these guys were the sort of the precursors to the DLC in many respect. And it was very much about sort of technocratic solutions and very deficit oriented and fiscal responsibility, that type of stuff that I don't know that I had the savviness as a kid to understand what the implications were. It was just like, Proposition 2.5 comes in, and you just assume it just sort of – I mean, it was voted on a referendum, right? But it's not – I don't have a sense of how it was sold to the Massachusetts public, but I just remember it was like, oh, there's no extracurriculars at my high school. Like, there's no – there's math and science and English and foreign language. And that, like, there was no – I honestly don't even think I had heard the word philosophy as, like, a study until I went to college. Like, I don't – I mean, I think people have that in high school, but it wasn't – our high school was not like that.
What I'm wondering, though, because you asked about the future trend, and I think she's probably right that there is this – and I obviously – pretty familiar with this group of voters and how they think about things from just like where I grew up and different social circles and stuff. But I think on the other hand, that type of voters definitely in New York, they broke for Bill de Blasio. They definitely seem like there's certain chunks within that coalition that is more interested in at least the possibility of discussing the economic injustice and the inequality questions. So I kind of wonder actually if you might see that coalition start to not exactly break apart because there's still enough overlap, but I think there's disagreements with inside that.
I think it has to do with, frankly, the perception that there's a generation, my age, I think, and younger, that they're not going to do as well as their parents, largely speaking.
Right.
And that it's consistent with the sort of MO of those people, right? I moved to the suburbs. I'm more concerned about my kids, the quality of my kids' school, which remains. But it's also sort of because you're living in those type of suburbs, the solution is pretty straightforward to maintain the quality of that education, right? There's not a lot of nuance involved in that. You're in a much more isolated situation. Now, if the next generation moves to the sort of the gentrified urban areas, it's you're just not quite as isolated. And the solutions to that become a little bit more nuanced, like maybe I actually have to get more involved in my kids' schools, and maybe it's just going to involve a slightly different type of lifestyle. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to sort of separate these things out, but I know, I mean, Worcester was not a suburb by any stretch of the imagination, but also it's not like it's not a city like Brooklyn. But, you know, it was there were four. Oh, there was a lot more elementary schools, but there were four high schools, and there was no, like, you just went to the one that you go to. There was no, I don't know. I mean, my perspective is a little bit tainted because I'm in, you know, greater New York City.
No, but I'm just wondering because I see, like, I can almost see three directions of the type of voter that she's talking about going in, because I think some of those people have almost just become – Republicans. Some of those people have gone
in Massachusetts.
In Massachusetts, I would say some people in Silicon Valley and in California have gone in the kind of libertarian thing. I think some of those voters, not a majority, but some. And I think she's right. There's a large group that really are like the Obama, Clinton type. Mm-hmm. And then I think you saw, like you're saying, with de Blasio, maybe people dealing with more interdependence in urban areas, there's some recognition that, you know, that you got to deal with inequality and that is at the heart of any type of concern of injustice or the environment or quality of life, in fact. And it makes a lot of sense, I guess, if you live in an urban environment that's just kind of more apparent to you. But I wonder if there's that kind of grouping is a little bit softer in the future, and it might be splitting up in some ways. I don't know. It's interesting.
We'll find out, I think. Maybe. Hopefully. All right. We're going to take a break, head into the fun half of the program. Hey, folks, let me tell you something. You can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Wait, you know what? Let's check the comments we got in iTunes. I want to see if we got a new one. Because yesterday, I don't think people heard this yesterday, or at least the freebeers did not hear this yesterday. I was asking people to leave comments in iTunes. And I found out that I went back to look at the comments, and I checked the comments. I don't know. Not that often, but like, I don't know. I try and do it like twice a month at least. I mean, I'd like to do it once a week, but I don't remember to do all that stuff. And back around the time when I went to do Marin's show, some guy had written like, oh, Sam Cedar taking time off. Look at that. We're at number two in what's hot right now in the news and politics. Right before Democracy Now! And above Real Time with Bill Maher. And I noticed that a dude had caught and copied the critique he left when I did Marin's show and dropped it in this week, which was Sam Cedar taking vacation again, going to come back and tell us about Alistair. And the guy obviously didn't listen to the show because I went to Vegas and did live shows there. There it is. Here it is. Sam skips another week, April 16th. Because I wasn't there on Wednesday. Sam skips another week. He'll return with crazy stories about his travels, but he will claim to have been out of touch on the news. Most of his listeners will stay current on events if they're lucky enough to get a vacation. But Sam will take better than 6 weeks and will totally check out. What is he talking about?
Just say what I love about that phrasing, and I know it isn't the main point, but I love that you will claim to not be up on the news, almost as if you're lying. Like, you actually have been reading the Social Security reports.
Let me get through this. And this, I said this yesterday. He'll waste a few episodes recounting his week, but he won't be up to speed on the recent outrages of the 24/7 news cycle. And it's also like, you know, there are times where it feels like maybe I want to unplug from that for, like, I don't know, 36 hours. He will need your $10, though. A hack, he writes. Now, here's a guy claiming that I'm a hack, doesn't even expend the effort to come up with another critique, just cuts and pastes what he wrote 2 months ago when I went to go do Marin Show during my daughter's vacation.
I love this. It's a new bit, though. It's just like, hey, man, I don't really know what happened to the news. I was too busy hanging out with my friends in L.A., but you got $10? I don't really have time to read anything. I'm going to go back on vacation again next week because my daughter's off.
I want
to
know what this other...
You got $10, man.
And then you go and look at what the other podcasts he's listening to.
We're looking.
He loves Greg Fitzsimmons' comedy thing. He loves Jimmy Dore show. Then go listen to Jimmy Dore. How many shows does Jimmy Dore do?
Yeah, what I don't get how many shows is that does Jimmy Dore do? Jimmy Dore does one a week, if he even does one a week.
I love this. In 2008, he writes Radiolab. Annoying. Annoying. By using collage and digital sound mixing, these people think they've arrived at some slick new way of telling a story. Instead, it's just simply a series of ticks that inhibit the transmission of any actual information. The more you listen, the more you're bored by their facile but repetitive approach. This guy only, I mean... Oh, but here's why he likes Jimmy Dore. It's free. Hey, 45 minutes a day, this show is free. I resent the fact that he asks for money, though.
The notion of making a living. At my job,
what I do at my job is I refuse to ask for money. And I just do so well that they end up paying me.
If they would like to pay me, they can do as they will.
If they don't want to, fine. It's their loss.
But one thing you will never have is a vacation and any interesting stories upon my return.
No, I shall never, ever tell you about what I've done.
Just as a matter of fact, last week, I hesitate to even say this, I took 2 days to write iTunes reviews and get into a vicious argument with my ex-wife over Gmail. But details? No, you won't be hearing them from me.
No.
I don't waste time like that.
You shall no longer
be paying me. Well, don't worry. You still will see me on Monday.
So, folks,
this American life, annoying.
Annoying. Serial, all they did was just stretch it out and make you wonder what was going to happen next.
It just expands to everything. The Big Bang, dreary, a dull concept. The internet, so played out.
Oh, my God.
Dunkin' Donuts, excellent products at a cheap price.
Sam's podcast, so predictable, shows up every day. We get it.
You get it. You podcast. Now, pardon me. I'm going to repost the same review that I wrote of you 3 weeks
yes,
ago.
Yes, exactly. And I will repost this one, too. And, you know, he also, like, deleted his last one. That's what's really annoying about it.
Very canny.
I need to maintain my integrity as a reviewer. And if people saw that I had written the same review, I want to make sure it's bumped up. So, folks, will you please, how about leaving us a review? Just like, how about
that one down, yeah.
How about, like, yeah. How about leaving another review saying, like, I hope Sam skips another week. Because I love to hear tales of what he does on his vacation.
he should also bump up the cost of his monthly podcast.
I don't know about 10. I think Sam.
I feel like paying $25 a month.
If only Sam would ask for $15 or $20. So tired of hearing him say $10.
Cereal stretched out.
What does this guy say when he's like watching a show he enjoys and then the season ends? Like, oh, what lazy people. The season has ended?
That's right.
Keep going.
Oh, it's the cable company. I suppose you'll want your payment.
At least they have the decency to not ask for it. Nearly just send a threatening letter.
I thought Game of Thrones was a fantastic television show, but after those 15 episodes, they took a break.
Wait a second. I just got tweeted. Record. All right, we're going to take this into the better half. But I just got tweeted that Worcester's the third biggest city in Massachusetts. I don't think so, Chief.
What would be bigger?
He thinks it's Springfield. No. I got news for you. Worcester, second biggest city in New England.
Yeah, yeah. That's so, common knowledge. Dude.
Yeah, I guess not with H. Feld on Twitter, who IMs the show. All right, we're going to take a break. Folks, for $10, join themajorityreport.com. Also, Just Coffee, only 8 more days. Get free shipping. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. I know. Oh, you mean we have to pay for the coffee? yes, but you get 10% off with the coupon.
You buy a bag and it ends at some point?
Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at Majority Report. What is it? MajorityReportKickback.com.
They say it themselves. It's a kickback.
Well, all right, 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me through the free app. You know what's great about that free app? I mean, this guy doesn't even comment about the app is free. It's been what now? 3 years? 2 years?
2 years.
Paid a lot of money for that app. I still haven't, like, it hasn't even occurred to me to monetize it. Well,
still,
Sam wants to put ads on his app. Why doesn't he just buy me a free app? I did. 2 years of free
app,
buddy.
If you want me to download your free app, Sam, you have to purchase me the phone.
Right, exactly. Oh, so easy.
Not once, Sam. Offer an app.
How about a phone first? You know, if Sam really wanted people to use his app, he would upgrade my phone. I've been stuck with an iPhone 5. Or a Galaxy 410, whatever, booba-dooba.
What, are you too lazy, Sam, to update my phone for me?
Yeah, exactly. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.